Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
All right, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. We are going to jump right into things. I'll give you a quick rundown of what we're doing here. If you have a question, the way to get into the question queue is to press 1. If you've already pressed 1, don't do it again. It takes you out of the queue. We take the calls in order, and we get to as many as we can in that hour. We have a lot of calls and a lot of questions. So the sooner you press 1, the higher the likelihood that we might get to your call. So let's jump right to it. Let's go to Indiana. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. What can I help you with today?
I got an Obamacare question for you. I know it's your favorite topic right now.
Oh, I love talking about that.
Yeah, I'm hoping you can give me some insight here. Just to give you a quick rundown, I'm an owner-operator. I drive for one of the van lines. I've been incorporated for, well, since 2000. And the issue I've got is, for the longest time, I was paying my own health insurance for my wife and I, and then she got a job where at a hospital where she got coverage for us, and then she quit that job and started a new job in October. And the old insurance carried over, but it ended on the 31st, and the new insurance picked up yesterday. And my question for you is, the new insurance, they want documentation from me that I'm self-employed and that I can't get insurance through my employer. Question you is, with me being incorporated, are they going to be able to say, well, I could get insurance through my corporation and deny me? Can
you
do that?
You are the only employee of the corporation?
Yes.
Okay. No, they won't, because that corporation changes nothing about health insurance. Nobody will cover you under the corporation that wouldn't cover you as an individual, because there's really no difference. They're not,
okay.
I mean, it's not a group policy. So, yeah, you could, did they say what kind of proof they want to show that?
That was the question I had for you. What could I give them to prove that I am self, because I'm not a self-proprietor, I'm an S-Corp. What would I show them?
I guess you could show them your corporate documents, and it lists you as the only owner. You obviously own 100% of the stock. I would try that. I can't believe they didn't give you a list of documents, because actually what they're trying to prove is not that you're self-employed. They're trying to prove that you're not employed by somebody. Well,
okay.
We can't. You can't prove a negative. I mean,
yeah.
You can say all day long, I'm not employed by somebody. So I guess proof would either be your corporate document, your initial corporate filing.
Is that thing called the Article of Declaration or something like that?
Exactly. That's what you should be able to send them. Or a tax return showing your income coming from that corporation that you own. I don't know. I mean, either one of those would show me, yeah, this guy has a corporation and, you know, this is where he makes his money. Whether or not they'll accept that, I would imagine they would. I don't know what else you would show them.
So you're talking show my joint return with my wife, my personal return?
You could show them both, the corporate and the personal, because that way you can follow the trail of the money. The corporate shows, you know, all the business expenses, and then what's left gets transferred to you on a K-1. Then you see the K-1 on your personal tax return. That's pretty clear. I mean, I don't know what else you could show them.
That's kind of what I was thinking, but I was more concerned to know if they were trying to get out of insuring me, what you thought about that. But.
Well, here's the thing. They can't. You know, as much as I hate this new law, they really can't because everybody has to be insured. It's not an option anymore. The government is forcing us to be insured. So there's always an option now. So if, for example, this company might look at you and go, oh, no, we don't do small corporations. Well, that's fine. Send, you know, write me a personal policy then. But even if they don't, somebody will. I mean, that's, I guess, the best news about this new law is somebody has to write you a policy.
Yeah, because all those years I was paying, we were paying pretty decent because I had a, you know, I had a really high deductible too. But then when she got that new job, and it really helped out, you know, on the bottom line, not having to pay that. And now I'm worried that they're going to try and get rid of me.
Yeah, well, they can't.
Okay.
Yeah, that is the new thing. Everybody gets covered. There's nobody that gets turned down for any reason anymore.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. As much as I don't like it, there are some times where it can create an advantage, and this is one of those. You will get covered. You might have to jump through a lot of hoops, but in the beginning, show them those two tax returns and your corporate declaration. That should be enough. Let's go to Utah. Phil, welcome to the program. All right, let's go to, where am I going here? I've got all kinds of, lots of calls and questions. Let's go to Alabama. Jason, welcome to the program.
Hello, how you doing today, Kevin? Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. What can I help you with today?
Yes, sir. My question that I have for you here, I've been on a track lease with the company here, and I'm just trying to see how would I go about doing my taxes this year. How would I do that if I'm with a track lease with them?
Who is the track lease with? Who is the lessor?
It's Trans Lease. I'm working with them.
Okay, because if it's truly a track lease, TRAC, that stands for Terminal Residual Account Clause, I think, or Accounting Clause, one of the two. That's a very, very specific kind of lease. Now, if it's a true track lease written the way it's supposed to, you could choose to depreciate that.
Oh, okay.
This is one of those that can get a little complicated, and before I could give final advice, I would actually have to see the lease. But if it's a true track lease written the way they're supposed to be written, then you could decide that that's just you're buying the truck, and you could say it's yours and depreciate it. Or the other option is you just take your lease payments as you make them. So for taxes this year, the easy way would be to go back, say, okay, here's all the lease payments I made, and take that as a deduction. That's the easy way. The harder way is reading the lease, and somebody has to read it that understands taxes and track leases and say, okay, this meets the requirements of depreciation, and if you depreciate it, then it gives you a lot more options.
Okay.
So
all
I wish
right,
I had
man.
An easier answer for you, but because our tax code is so complicated, the easy answer is write off your lease payments. The better answer is you might be able to find a better tax advantage if we can depreciate this, but I'd have to read the lease to know that.
Okay. Do you still do the taxes also?
We're going to start up again this year on a very, very limited basis. So probably sometime in February we'll announce. I mean, we may only do 25 tax returns this year. We might do 100. I haven't figured it out yet. It depends on, we have so many projects going on right now. We're trying to get going for the beginning of the year. So in February, I'll make the call. We just want to kind of jump back in, get our feet wet, and make sure we service everybody well this year. And then we'll start growing it throughout the year.
Okay. Well, I want to get in line then. I'd like to be one of those peoples.
All right. You're obviously on our notification list, right?
Yes, sir. Sure is.
Okay. So as soon as we pick that number, we'll send out, you know, a mass message and saying it's open, we're going to take the first 25 people or 100 or whatever that number is.
Okay. All right. That sounds good, sir. Now, thank you for your help.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go this time to Indianapolis. Ray, welcome to the program.
Hey, Chief. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
I heard a couple of weeks ago an owner-operator talking about having his company audited over a gift tax discrepancy that they weren't reporting his taxes correctly.
Right.
And so what I did, I'm an independent, and I went and dug up the IFTA rule book that all motor carriers are required to have on file. And it said that the owner of a truck is responsible for the IFTA taxes. So in the case of an owner-operator, the owner-operator is ultimately responsible for the correct reporting of the IFTA taxes. And in the case of an audit, when the IFTA department comes to the motor carrier and finds a discrepancy, they're not going to say, oh, well, since you reported, you're the one responsible. It doesn't work that way. It's they're going to go to the owner-operator and say, well, the taxes didn't get filed right, and you're responsible, so you're going to pay a penalty and a fine and interest on both. And also, I also wanted to point out that it's in the advantage of every owner-operator or for every truck owner to report every single mile that that truck operates, because in the equation of finding miles per gallon, the miles, which is the denominator in the equation, anytime you increase the miles, you increase the effective outcome of the coefficient, which is miles per gallon. So what happens is you report all your miles, and your miles per gallon goes up, and in essence, you're going to be paying less taxes. So it really is important that every owner-operator make sure that their carrier is reporting all of their miles. And I think what happens is a lot of them use pro miles or, I can't remember the other one, PC Miler. And when they pay that carrier, they draft a ticket for that load, and it comes up automatically with the miles, and through the computer system, the miles filter through to the IFTA tax report, and that's what they put on your report. And so nobody's going in there and updating off your trip sheet or whatever information that you're giving to the carrier your exact miles. So you have to go to the carrier and say, hey, these are my miles for each trip, this and this and this and this, so that when they do generate their IFTA fuel tax report and submit it to the IFTA department, that your miles are correct.
Everything you've said so far is absolutely correct. And I agree. You know, there was a time where I used to say, hey, you know what? The carriers are doing it. Let them do it. It's one less thing you've got to worry about. Until I saw that because the carriers do it, owner-operators don't have a clue how it works. Most carriers are screwing up the reporting. And like you said, doesn't cost the carrier anymore. It ends up costing the owner-operator more. So I think that good owner operators should just opt out of their carrier's program and take care of this themselves.
Right, and the base state should have forms, or they undoubtedly have forms that you can go and file to opt out of it. And what they'll ask for is your lease agreement and the contract under which you purchased your vehicle. Or your truck, pump. So if you have a track lease or whatever, so you just have to submit those two documents, and
right.
And then you're on your own.
Yeah, and you know that it's going to be accurate. You know that you're going to, you know, like you said, you can make sure all the miles get in, so your fuel economy is more favorable, so you'll ultimately end up paying less tax. The mistakes, I see so many carriers make so many mistakes, and owner-operators don't understand it. They see the numbers and figure it must be right, and many times it's not. It's not even close. So, you know, that's probably something I'll put, you know, more emphasis on this year, is getting owner-operators to opt out of that program and do their own.
Absolutely. Please do. When I was an owner-operator, that's how I figured out what was going on with the PC Miler and such. But I do my IFTTA taxes on an Excel spreadsheet now, which is fairly complicated. And I would not try to teach somebody how to do it on Excel. But what I do recommend the owner-operators that I mentor is that they find one of those tax services that actually do it for you. That way, all they have to do is report the miles for each state they operated in, their total miles, and then that tax service will generate the reports that they need to have, which are the quarterly and monthly reports and all the routes that they drove in and stuff like that. And I think there's a couple of services out there that only do it for $15 a month. So
yeah,
it's somewhat looking at it.
There are a couple ways to get this done, and ProMiles being one of them. And ProMiles, if you use the fuel optimization side, saves you a couple $1,000s a year in fuel cost, and then all of your information is already in there. Now, you do have to make sure you get your miles correct and make sure you're showing all the miles, but it's also getting easier and easier to do this online because most of the states now have this available online. So that's another great option, and it's getting easier to do. So I think that's something we're going to put a bigger push on this year. Let's go to Colorado. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Yes, Kevin, how are you doing? And Happy New Year's to you.
Happy New Year's. What can I help you with today?
Yes, Kevin. I have a question. I heard earlier last week something about it. You mentioned $70,000 net should be considered one corporation.
Yeah, we start at $60,000 is when you should be looking. By the time you're netting $70,000, I can almost guarantee that you should be incorporated.
Okay. Now, I guess my question with that statement is, I'm also retired military. Do I add that to it? Because I know I will as a sole proprietor, but will I add that with the corporation?
Let me think for just a no, that won't have any bearing on this. We're only looking at business itself to see if there's enough of an advantage to be incorporated, so other income won't affect that.
Okay, great. And the other question, Kevin, is the CMC. Are you covering any type of kind of hands-on maintenance, something that you can say, this is what right should look like?
This is what should look like?
This is what right should look like. This is what it should look like.
Yeah. Actually, we do a lot of hands-on maintenance. You get a full day of maintenance stuff. Half the day is mostly engine-related from Bruce Mallinson and Fernando at Pittsburgh Power. Half the day is Mike Beckett, where he talks about alignment and tires and tire wear. And then on Friday, we have a workshop outside where we have all kinds of hands-on station set up where you can go. You know, we have people who understand electrical and fuel systems, and they're doing demonstrations, and you can, you know, spend as much time as you want with those people. On Friday, the whole morning Friday, we're out in the parking lot, and it's hands-on maintenance kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm
saying. Yep, you'll love it. In fact, one of the issues that we deal with is for some people, they say there's too much maintenance. This year, we're looking at possibly giving some people some options. If they don't want to do the maintenance stuff, maybe they can go learn about spreadsheets or, you know, other topics. But we're not going to cut out any of the maintenance because it's really good stuff.
Right, exactly. Okay. Appreciate you, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. All right, let's head to Alabama. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got a question about insurance for trucks, insuring the truck and the trailer and the cargo. I've gotten quoted what I think are outrageous prices, $1,000 a month to $1,500 a month.
Okay, so we are talking about your own authority, so you need primary liability and cargo, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so the one thing I do know about insurance rates is they are all over the board. They change, it seems to me, almost constantly, and it doesn't have much to do with anything else. Like most things just tend to go up in price over time with inflation and other things. When I look at insurance, there was a time 20 years ago where people were paying $15,000 a year for insurance if they had their own authority. Then over time, I can remember a couple years where people were paying $5,000 or $6,000 a year, like one third. And then it started climbing again, and we seem to be back in that place where it's just expensive again. And I don't shop for that kind of insurance, so I can only tell you what I see. You know, typically I'll see it when I go in and look at people's business reports and profit gauges. And I've been noticing lately that insurance, if you're have your own authority, seems to be getting pretty darn expensive again, and it seems to be right about where you're talking about, $1,000 to $1,500. Now, the only way to know that for sure is just to keep getting as many estimates as you can.
Right. Okay. Or would it be better for me to go under somebody else's authority, and then I would run off their insurance? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but they're also going to take a bunch of the money. So, I mean, I'd much rather, insurance is expensive, but rates have gone up somewhat. So all I really care about is how much is left over. I don't care if I have to pay $100,000 for insurance a year. If I'm making $500,000, it might work out.
Right.
So if you go to work under somebody's authority, they're going to charge you for that option. They're going to charge you possibly for insurance. They're going to charge you administrative. They're going to take part of the profit because that's what they do. It's their insurance. It's their authority. They deserve to get some of the money. That's kind of
right.
The idea of going out on your own authority is saying, hey, wait a minute. I want all the money. I'll pay all the expenses, but I want all the money.
Right. Just if you did decide to go under somebody else's authority, I mean, it's like, 8%, 10% about the going right now? I don't know.
Oh, it's all over the board. You know, take an example like Landstar where, you know, Landstar does a lot for their BCOs, but I think they're taking like 33%.
Okay.
Yeah, I think now that's also without a trailer. I think it probably goes up to 70-some if you've got a trailer. So there's lots of factors. Now, I do know people that'll say, hey, come on over, use our authority, use our insurance. You go find your own freight and don't bother me. Just send me the paperwork, I'll bill it, and I'll pay you. The going rate for that seems to be about 10%.
Okay.
So really just depends. You know, if you're at that place where you think it's time to go get your own authority, then insurance is just one of the costs of doing business. But it does seem to be going up. Let's go to New Mexico. Scott, welcome to the program.
Happy New Year, Kevin.
Happy New Year. What can I help you with today?
Well, you've said many occasions that adding synthetic oil and running that in my big truck will aid my fuel economy. What will that do in our family vehicles? As we
have one here that
inhales gasoline.
Yeah, you're not going to see any big change. Synthetic oil in any engine will improve fuel economy because it's a lighter, thinner oil. But you're not going to take a gas guzzler and turn it into a Prius because you put, you know, synthetic in it.
Okay, and I can give a partial answer to that lady about asking about insurance rates because it's what Marilyn and I ran into when we started.
Yeah,
we found our insurance started out at about $9,000 a year. We had to give them, I think we had to give them $3,500 up front and then finance the rest of it out. But when I went to haul one particular product, told it's a high-value, high-risk, highly hijacked commodity, copper, and I had to change cargo insurance carriers because the carrier that my agent wrote me with didn't cover loads of copper. I actually got a better break on the cargo insurance with the second carrier, and I'm down, we're paying about $612 a month for insurance now, and I was told when we started that I've got some offshoot company that's writing my policy because the bigger guys don't want to take new ventures. You don't have a track record. So they said till you've been out here anywhere from 3 to 5 years that none of the big boys that can give you a better break really want much to do with you until you can come to them with a proven safety record. But
yeah, and the things like that with insurance are fairly common. That I think that's why insurance rates go up and down all the time, is because the climate changes as far as claims and how much they're paying out. And it seems like we're back into that cycle where people are paying more and having a harder time getting insurance.
Well, that's what we've found. And the funny thing is, I've got 30 years experience and over 2 million miles accident free, and I was kind of let down to be told that that doesn't mean anything.
I think we're having an audio issue. Can everybody hear me now? Hold on 1 second. We're checking sound. Okay. All right. So, all right. It looks like I'm back. I'm having some audio issues, but we'll just keep moving along here. Let's go to Kansas. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you doing?
Doing great. What can I help you with today?
Hey, I was perusing on truck paper, doing some drilling on some glider kits, because that's what I would like to do with my truck, and I come across, I believe it's a Freightliner dealer up there in Hartford, and they were advertising a Freightliner Argosy calfover, glider camper, 2015. And I was wondering, you know, they advertised it with a Detroit, but I've got a cat, and I kind of like to keep it. Is it still the same rules with those Argosys, or?
Yeah, nothing would change. As far as gliders go, the rules are the rules, and it's up to all the individual truck manufacturers what they want to offer. And gliders are becoming more popular. Like right now, we're building a Kenworth. That wasn't available a couple years ago. Peterbilt made some of their trucks available as gliders. So it's interesting that the Argosy is back. And honestly, I would consider building a cab over. I like cab overs.
Well, I do too. I've never driven one, but I've got a dedicated run that goes into Denver. And the stores that I go to, some of them aren't built for a car, let alone a truck.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of a cab over. They're so much more maneuverable in tight spots. Once we got Air Ride, now, you know, I owned a lot of Spring Ride cab overs, and those were rough trucks. But the Air Ride and a lot of the technology has changed that. So I'll do some looking. I didn't realize they were offering the Argosy as a glider option.
Well, and from, you know, just a Google search that I had done, there was some, of course, you know, been on online forums, you know, how truthful a lot of them are. But I guess in Canada you could got them, and they're kind of fairly new to the United States, but they're different looking. You know, there's only the one picture that's up on Truck Paper's website. And so I was just, because I've got, you know, C12 and love the daylights out of this little truck, and I like to, you know, just.
Yeah, and I don't think that putting a cat in an Argosy would be all that difficult, because there was a time when that was an available option.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
what
some
I saw.
Some of the trucks, like right now, us building this T660, There never was a Detroit available in that truck. So we have to come up with wiring harnesses and a lot of other parts, and it's much more expensive to build. That's why we're trying to put together the kit and see if we can make this, you know, affordable or not. But an Argosy was available, if I remember right, with a lot of different engines, and it should be much easier to find the parts to build that. Even with the CAD, I don't think that should be a problem.
Yeah, I was thinking, I haven't tried getting a hold of the dealer to, you know, see what any information about them, because I can't even find a brochure or anything about it.
Yeah, I'll do some digging and see what I can come up with.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks
for the heads up on that. Hey, everybody, be patient for just a second. I am still having some audio issues, so I'm going to try a couple things here and... Test 1, 2. All right, we're going to get back to the call. Still haven't figured out the audio issue, but we're just going to have to deal on it. Let's go to Wisconsin. Curry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much, Kevin. Hey, I've got a question. I've got a 2010 International with an ISX in it. Been a great truck. I've had no problems. But now, all of a sudden, my oil sample is showing high in sodium, and I had it checked at 15,000, and it was down naturally, but it's still showing high in sodium, but it's not showing any glycol. I've had the EGR checked twice. I mean, they've gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. I even stayed in there with them this last time. They pressure checked it. We let it run outside, brought it in. Did it again, still couldn't find any leaks. How do you know if it's a liner or an injector cup leaking or something like that without just tearing into it?
Have you done any oil samples?
Yeah, that's what gave me the heads up on my high sodium.
Okay. And is this an EGR engine?
Oh, yes, sir. It's 2010.
Okay, so there really isn't any way to know other than doing some troubleshooting. So we do like to start with the easy stuff first. So we want to make sure that it isn't an EGR cooler because that's easier than tearing into an engine. We want to make sure it's not an oil cooler because that's easier than tearing into an engine. But pretty much if we've eliminated those two, then we're down to tearing into the engine to figure it out. Now, we start at the top, obviously, and look for a cracked head or a head gasket. And that's, if it's not the EGR, the oil cooler, the next most likely thing is a cracked head or a head gasket. And then after that, it could potentially be a liner, which would be the worst thing, but that's, unless you've had a major coolant problem, that's not very likely.
Okay. I don't blow any white smoke at all, except when it comes on, you know, when my exhaust gets hot and it regens, that's the only time it does. That's about every 350 miles. And I tell you, I'm just stumped on it.
Now,
any ideas on what to do?
What was the level of the coolant in the oil?
This last time it was 205 parts per million.
Sodium or potassium or both?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said sodium. Well, it was potassium.
What is your sodium elevated?
It's 28. It shows normal.
Oh, you might not have a coolant. Are you losing coolant?
Yeah. It's funny. I may go a week and not lose any. And then I may go a day and lose a half gallon, go another day and lose another half, and then I may not lose any more for another week.
Oh, yeah, you've got a really strange issue here, and I'm not sure what it is. Because that's unusual.
Yeah. Huh. What were you thinking there when you said I may not even have a coolant leak?
Well, if you weren't losing coolant, but we have...
Uh-huh.
Just potassium showing up in the oil sample, I've seen that before, and it turns out that sometimes that's just an environmental contaminant. Now, if we have
both
potassium and sodium, then it's pretty clear then that we've got a coolant leak. But I've seen lots of cases, especially in the wintertime when they're using all kinds of weird chemicals on the road. We tend to see sodium certainly goes up in some people's oil samples because of salt on the road. And it finds its way into the crankcase, and that's enough to give us elevated potassium. We do see that sometimes people that haul into chemical plants, it happens with them. But if you've got high potassium and you keep losing coolant, the odds are it probably is a coolant leak, and it probably is getting into the engine. But I would check EGR cooler first.
Okay. They've checked that twice in the last 45 days. Recently, they just checked it like a week ago. And, I mean, they spent a lot of time on this thing then and could not find it. Bad part is I got this thing will be paid off in April. Dadgum.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now... I read online that some of these oil filters contain potassium. Now, let me tell you something else. I just started recently using Lucas, and that's when this potassium started showing up.
Yeah, see, I don't think I would tear into this engine yet. Here's the really weird thing that's possible. You might be getting the potassium from someplace else. Since we're not getting sodium, maybe it is just potassium from this filter, from the oil, from somewhere else, and you have a cold water leak. I'm sorry, a hot water leak. So that what's happening is you're only losing coolant when you're going down the road, and in some cases, it's only under certain conditions. Like on a really hard pull when the engine gets to a certain temperature, it's enough pressure in the system to cause the leak, and that's why you're seeing it intermittently.
Okay, now that's a good point, because like when I run through Flagstaff on 40 that way, heading west, that's when I seem to lose most of it.
So the way you can look for that is get the truck into a nice, warm, comfortable shop when you've got time. Get an inspection light, maybe even an inspection camera with the little flexible neck, and you just have to crawl all over this truck, inside, outside, underneath, and look for evidence of coolant somewhere. Because if it's happening when you're driving, the odds are it's blowing out, it's drying, and you're not seeing the leak anywhere, but you might be able to find evidence that it was leaking.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes me feel better.
be a possibility. You've got such a weird case going on there that might be what we're dealing with here. Let's go to Oklahoma. Alan, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Mr. Rutherford?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
Well, I've got an 04 T600, and I've got 450-gallon capacity tanks on it. I've got two 150s and two 75s behind them. And when I do get a chance to fuel all the way up, the weight issue on the front axle makes me run my gap so wide that I know it's just eating me alive. And question is, how do you, because I'm registered at 80,000, you know, would it be better for me to go up to 85,000 on the register or lose the 75-gallon tank?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, maybe I'm missing something. Why don't you just get rid of the tanks?
Well, that would probably just be the easiest way. I just kind of like, you know, hitting a state with a good, reasonable fuel and eating it, you know, filling it up.
It's kind of nice. It's probably not worth the trade-off, because if you can't fill up, then you can't track your fuel mileage, which is, in my opinion, much more important to be able to track every tank than it is to get, you know, a little bit of cheaper fuel here and there. And then if it's screwing up your weight and making you the gap much bigger, I think you'd be far better off to just lose those tanks.
But that sounds like an easier fix.
Yeah, and then you can go back to topping off whenever you want to and not worry about the weight.
All right, well, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go this time to Tennessee. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing this afternoon?
Doing good. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'm a licensed insurance agent out of Texas, as well as a truck driver, and I've got the answer for your first caller tonight.
Oh, good.
What he's dealing with his wife's company, is they are a self-insured large group.
Hold on a second. What happened was his wife doesn't have that job anymore.
Yeah, but he said she got a different job, and the new job is asking for his proof.
No, I thought he was trying to get his own insurance.
No, he's having trouble getting on his wife's policy at a new job.
Oh, okay. I must have missed that somewhere. I completely misunderstood the question. I thought he was applying for his own.
Yeah, so they're a self-insured large group, which under the HIPAA rules, they're not required to write an insurance for a spouse or dependent that is eligible for insurance through their own employment. All they're looking for is his 1040 and his Schedule SE, and that'll get him out of the woods.
Well, then what's going to happen? They can still just say, we're not going to cover you, though, right?
No. As long as since he's not eligible through an employer, and he's self-employed, the SE will show that, and as long as he's not eligible through an employer or eligible for Medicare or Medicaid, then they must write him. They can surcharge it, but they must write him.
Okay, so his best bet then would be to show them the proof, find out what the cost is going to be, and then go out and apply for his own as well. You'd want to compare the pricing. He might get it cheaper on his own.
Exactly. But what they're looking for is a 1040 in the Schedule SE to show that he's self-employed. That makes him by default not eligible for group insurance from an employer.
Well, he's not going to have an SE because he's got a corporation.
Okay, is Schedule C then?
He won't have a Schedule C either. He's going to have a Schedule K. He's going to have a K-1.
Okay.
The K-1 will show the income from his corporation. The K-1 is what moves it over to the personal side. So that's why I told him, show him the 1040 and the K-1.
Yeah, that'll work too. Anything that shows that he's not a W-2 employee.
Right, and that the K-1 would be what would do that.
Correct. Now, I've got a question about accelerated depreciation.
Okay.
I bought a truck for $63,000 in April of this year, which is actually when I started my business, went from being a company driver back to being an owner-operator.
Okay.
I don't need the entire $63,000 this year for depreciation with due to startup expenses and so forth and so on. Can I take any portion of that and then defer the rest of it for the next 2 years?
Oh, absolutely. You'll actually be deferring it for the next three. I know what they call it, a three-year schedule, but it ends up on four tax returns. It's just the screwy IRS. But what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to put the $63,000 into a three-year depreciation schedule, not take anything up front, and put it into what's called straight-line depreciation. That will give you the smallest amount of depreciation this year that you can take.
Well, I really want to take about $29,000 this year if I can.
So there's two ways you can do that. You can plug it into a depreciation schedule at what's called 200 dB. Now, $63,000 divided by 3, $21,000 divided by 2 is 1050. You're probably, in order to get 29,000, you're probably going to want to put it into 200 dB, which still isn't going to get you there, and then take a little bit of the depreciation under what's called Section 179. So let's say we plug it into a 200 dB, and it comes back and says, okay, your first year depreciation is going to be $23,000. And you can say, okay, I'll add another $6,000 from my Section 179 and get to take exactly what you wanted to take, $29,000.
That was my question, if I could split between between 179 and the straight-line depreciation or the 200 dB.
Or 200 dB, either one, and then you can add your Section 179 on top of it to get to the number you're trying to get to.
And then take that off the back end?
Yep.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it. By the way, I hope you go out of business on your tax preparation, Fair Tax Now.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. I agree. I hope I do too. Let's go to Colorado. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Doing good. What can I help you with tonight?
Well, I actually had a fuel tax question, but after hearing that one guy that called in, I realized I really don't know anything about fuel tax, so maybe I should hold off on that.
Let's try it.
I became an owner-operator last year, so I wasn't really worried about that because, I mean, I like my company. I've been with them a long time, so I kind of trusted them on that. I wanted to learn everything else first, and then I'd worry about the fuel tax, but it seems like it's usually around $30 a month I got to pay, and then every once in a while I get hit real hard, like $75, $90 a month, and I just can't figure out why. Why
okay,
it jumped
so,
that much.
So your carrier is taking money out every month?
Yeah, every month I get a fuel tax for the month before.
Okay, so I have a feeling your carrier has just got a very screwy system because we only pay fuel tax every quarter.
Right.
And
that's what somebody else had said too.
Yeah. Now the number could be all over the board. So the fact that you have $30 1 month, $75, that's not a concern at all. That's easily explained just based on where you drive and where you buy your fuel. Now it could also mean that you're not buying your fuel properly.
Okay.
And that could be costing you money. The way that we buy fuel is you can't look at the pump price when you're trying to decide where to get the cheapest fuel. What you have to do is take the pump price and subtract that state's fuel tax rate. Then you see what you're buying. And if you do that, most of the time the fuel tax that you owe at the end of the quarter will get smaller or you'll actually start getting refunds. That's not always true, but it's a pretty good bet that people who buy their fuel properly usually end up getting refunds back.
I usually buy it where I need a shower.
which is probably costing you a couple $1,000s a year.
Oh, God. All right. Well, we're going to get on that next then. I was going to put the fuel tax thing off for a while, but I got another buddy that is an owner-operator here, too. And like I said, they're a pretty good company, but he wants to get on our own IFTA. And I don't know if I can do that because I'm under a lease purchase with them.
You might not have the freedom. That's going to be up to them because they own the truck. So odds are in a lease purchase, they probably won't let you file the IFTA.
Right. Well, I should own the truck in a few years. I think what I'll do now is just learn how this works, keep an eye on it. When I can get my own, I'll be ready to do that.
I'm writing a tutorial. I haven't decided if it's going to be a book, an online video, or if I do it right, I can easily explain fuel tax in about 20 minutes if I can put numbers in front of somebody. So I'm probably going to make it an online video so you can see me filling in the numbers. And once you get, then you look around and you go, well, this is easy. Why doesn't everybody else get it? But until you get it, it's very confusing.
Yeah. That's why I kind of just left it alone right now. I had other stuff to worry about. I don't want you to be too confused, you know. But all right, I'll keep
good
my eye open for that. But I got one more question for you. My Freightliner, you know, it's got the readout on the dashboard about the fuel mileage, you know, your average fuel mileage. And I have a scan gate at home. I just haven't got home to get it yet. My wife got it for Christmas. But I'm wondering how close is it going to be to what my ECM tells me?
If we could synchronize the time period, like I don't know which readout you have on the dash. Does yours show you an actual fuel mileage number?
Like right now, I ran from Denver and I'm over in Kansas, and it's showing my average fuel at 9.4 because I'm empty.
Okay.
And that's my other question. When I put load on here tomorrow, it's going to go all the way down to 5.3, and I'm running at 57 miles an hour.
Oh, you've got a mechanical problem then.
That's what I was thinking, too. I just changed the fuel filter, so that might help, too, but...
That's too big of a jump. We certainly expect when you go from empty to 40,000 pounds, you're obviously going to lose fuel economy. But we can calculate how much, and you're losing way more than we'd expect.
And that's what I thought, too. I thought it was way off. But like I said, I changed the fuel filter, and I haven't had a heavy load on since then, so I'm going to find out tomorrow.
Now, here's the other thing. We don't ever trust the ECM for our real fuel mileage. We don't even trust the scan gauge because the scan gauge is really getting the same information as your dash is. Now, we might manipulate the numbers a little differently. But that's really it. It's going to be very close to what you're seeing. And especially if we're trying to troubleshoot a problem, we want to use real numbers. So you need to calculate this tank to tank.
And that leads me to the other question that I was just going to ask Lisa. She was going to bring up my profit gauges, and then I got disconnected, so I don't know where we're at with that. But I just started profit gauges, and like I said, I got the scan gauge. I've got some stuff that I did. I did a load, and I had some fuel on last year on the 31st, and they didn't process it till the day, my company. So it's not on my settlement till 2014. So we wasn't sure how to add that in, profit gauges. Do I back up and add that in?
No. If it's on a settlement that's dated in 2014, then that's when the deduction's going to be legitimate. Even though you spent it last year, because it got moved to a settlement that's dated in this year, it becomes this year's transaction.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll put it in the profit gauges now. But I didn't know about the fuel because I got 300 gallons tanks on here. I have 250 gallons, and I very rarely get to fill it up. But what I was going to do for fuel gauges was I put in 180 gallons now today, and I was going to put in the rest tomorrow and top it off. If I put both of those in, will that calculate as a full tank? Can I do it that way? Or
you know what I would rather see you do, because it's more accurate, put in today's fuel up as a partial. So you check that box that says partial. Tomorrow, put in the next fuel receipt and don't check partial, and then it will calculate both of them correctly.
Okay, so we did do today as a partial, but see, that's what screwed me up, Kevin, is because I got three fuels in December that we weren't putting into the gauges yet. So we were going to wait till January 1st, and those showed up on this year's settlement already.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
I don't know if I can go back and put those in.
Yeah, you can, and you can change the date if you need to.
Okay.
You know, the date doesn't, if it's showing up tax-wise in January, then just change the date of the fuel up till January. Make sure you put them in at least one day apart, and that'll be fine.
Right. And then add that into the profit gauges and stuff, because I wanted the numbers to all match up. Okay, I understand. So the dates don't really matter. Only I know the dates anyway. So
you're right. And that's, as long as you remember that, the dates don't matter. Make it work so that it works for you.
All right. Well, listen, when I get this load on tomorrow, if this thing drops back down to 5.5, next time you do this, I'll call again and I'll tell you. But I'm hoping it was
good.
A fuel filter, because it was clogged up pretty bad.
Yeah, and that would actually cause it, because you're putting more demand on the engine and it just can't get the fuel it needs for that demand.
I didn't know this is that. I talked to you a couple weeks ago. This is a 2006 with the EGR that I have bypassed with the barometric pressure switch, and I didn't know if
was
killing me when I was loaded.
No, that won't have anything to do with it. So the fuel filter might have been, so check it out. Call me back, and I'll go into fuel gauges, and I'll look at your numbers if it's still doing it. We'll see if we can figure it out. We have time for one more call, and then we're going to have to get out of here. Noah in Arkansas, your turn.
Hey, how you doing today?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
I've got a question. I've got a 9200 Eagle. It's got the 270. It's an old Walmart truck. It's got the 279 with the 10-speed direct.
Okay.
I've had a driver break two yokes already. The back of the transmission has been put back together already. For my type of work, I don't think that 279 is working now. I've had somebody tell me I can throw a 15-speed in there. I'm just trying to figure out if I can just change one component, if I got to change the tranny and the rears.
No, you could change one or the other. You could change the rear end ratio, or you could put in a transmission with a lower starting and a lower reverse ratio. Obviously, the rear ends are cheaper to change usually. Tell me about your operation, though.
It's mainly grain coming out of fields and stuff like that. So
part
of the problem, where they'll get loaded up in a field, they'll kind of dig in a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and that'll do it. A lot of the 15 speeds have very, very low bottom ends. They're hard to find. I mean, they're around. If you could find a 15 speed at a reasonable price, I might consider that, because that way you can keep your direct drive gears, which are a good thing. But if not, you could always change those 279s. What transmission do you have right now?
I'm not sure the model number. It's Eaton Fuller 10-speed.
So you're running in 10th gear, so this must be a 10-speed direct.
Yeah, it's a direct.
Okay, you can't change gears then. You've got to change at least the transmission. We can't change gears because you've got a direct drive transmission. I thought maybe we had a 13-speed and we were running it in direct. So,
yeah,
you've got a true direct drive. You've got to change the transmission.
Okay. What would you suggest going to?
If you could find the 15-speed, that'd be ideal with a really low bottom end because then you could keep your 279s. But otherwise, you're going to have to go with a 10 or a 13, and I would recommend a 13-speed overdrive, and then you're going to have to change the rear end gears. You're going to have to do both if you get a 13 or an 18-speed, unless you can find some model out there that's got a really, really low first and reverse. But the 15-speed, I think, is the transmission that gives you the most options when it comes to that. So look around, see what you find, and if you can call me with some ratios, like the bottom end on the transmission, I can calculate startability for you, and we could calculate final ratios. You just have to give me some options to work with. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you back here next time. You're on the Road Dog Sirius XM 128. Oh, no, you're not. You're on my podcast. Thanks for joining me anyway. We'll see you back here next time. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone.